Hello and welcome once again to Wrestling Memories Then and Now on Pioneer 90.1 FM KSRQ. We're available online at RadioNorthland.org, where you can listen to us live, and you can listen to past episodes of Wrestling Memories Then and Now. Hi, I'm Glenn Broggett, sitting all by myself this week. The grizzled vet, Mike McCurdy, is on assignment. Yes, he'll be back here in upcoming editions of the show in the month of December. But anyway, I have a very special guest while Mike's away, and it's kind of, you know, Mike does these profiles of some indie companies down in Texas where he lives. So I'm going to take it upon myself to not just cover an indie company per se, but one of the guys who I remember his pro wrestling story following him in the Grand Forks Herald. Yes, because this is a guy that kind of has ties to the Wrestling Memories listening area beyond. This is before we go into the internet and beyond. This is our radio listening area. Yes, Grand Forks is very much a part of Pioneer 90.1. But anyway, I remember this guy when he started pro wrestling, his pro wrestling journey. I remember him when he came back to Grand Forks, to the Grand Cities area for a big show, almost his homecoming of sorts in the late 80s, early 90s. And I remember also hearing about some of his work on the Minnesota Indies for Pro Wrestling America with Eddie Sharkey's company. Some of the stuff he did outside of Minnesota in the Midwest. West and beyond. He's got an interesting story to tell, and we'll find out what he's been up to outside of pro wrestling, and we're going to have to get at least one story of his time that he worked for Herb Abrams UWF. It's a big pleasure, and it's wonderful to have him on the program. The Judge, Mr. Randy Gust, welcome to Wrestling Memories.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This is a blast from the past. I mean, my wrestling days been a little bit behind me, but there's still, I mean, it was one of the best parts of my life in the business of pro wrestling, and you know, it's just fun to talk about it, because I haven't talked about my pro wrestling days for a long, long time. So you know, it's thank you for having me, and it'll be fun talking about that stuff.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you on. Like I said, man, I remember the announcement that you had gone and become a professional wrestler in the Grand Forks Herald sports section. How's that for a blast from the past?
That had to be close to 30 years ago. Yeah, wow, that is a blast from the past. Yeah.
Oh man, let's talk a little bit about your life before pro wrestling. I want to talk about when you were younger. What drew you to pro wrestling, and where, you know, what was it that bit you as far as the pro wrestling bug? But let's talk about the early pre Randy Gusto days.
You know, honestly, when I was a young kid, I loved two things. I loved watching the Minnesota Vikings in the 70s, and I loved watching AWA pro wrestling, Vern Gagne. And I had always, I mean, those were the two passions I had. And I loved pro wrestling. And, you know, I'd watch it either every Saturday night or Sunday morning, whenever it was on. You know, we didn't have cable, because actually, I mean, I grew up in Chirac, Minnesota, which is only like 40 miles from Thief River Falls down Highway 21. That's where my brother still lives, in the farmhouse right there. But, I mean, we had three channels, and wrestling was on one of them. And I would watch it when it was on, and I always wanted to do it, but I never thought, realistically I probably wouldn't. But it all started because I had a real good amateur career. And I went to the University of North Dakota and was pretty successful in the heavyweight division there. And Vern Gagne, because of an amateur himself, national champ from Minnesota, he liked amateur wrestlers. So, I mean, when my career was done at the University of North Dakota, I was the one that called him and Brad Rangins, and I wanted to see if I could get into it. They got back to me, and from there, I basically, that's how it all started, because of my career at the University of North Dakota wrestling and my amateur background, because Vern and Brad being a, you know, Olympic Greco wrestler, you know, one of the best in the world, that's where it all started for me and how I got into it. My trainers, when I was in camp, it was mainly, Vern would come and visit, you know, about once a week or so, but it was Brad Rangins. He had a place in Hamel, Minnesota, with a big workout shed where they had a ring, they had an Olympic mat, they had weights, They had a big log. I mean, they had all that stuff. And we would be training. And actually, the assistant trainer at the time, if you know, was Wayne Bloom. Wayne Bloom was the assistant trainer, you know, who was Wayne the Train Bloom, and then went on to be one of the Beverly Brothers in the WWE, and down in WCW, he worked there too. But yeah, that's where it started with Brad. Brad was the one. It was called Worldwide Professional School of Wrestling.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the training, because I mean, you had obviously you were an athlete, you were a college wrestler. But what was the differences as far as conditioning went and training went? You know, when you got into the world of amateur wrestling to the world of pro wrestling, what was the some of the differences and maybe even some of the similarities as far as getting yourself conditioned and ring ready?
Well, I think the biggest thing, because, you know, pro wrestling, you know what I mean, it is, and I mean, enough people know it now, is entertainment. So what I had to get myself adjusted to from being an amateur wrestler was the slower pace in the ring, the tie-ups, and I mean, and, you know, just getting the timing. Because everything for me, an amateur, was go, go, go. You know, but here it was a little, and there was times you had to maybe, Brad would have us in the ring wrestling for an hour at a time. You know, the one thing that was real similar is, from amateur to pro, was your conditioning. If you weren't in shape, ring shape or mat shape, you were going to get thrown, you know, you were going to get real tired real fast, and then everything would usually go haywire from there. Because once you're tired, you know, physically, you're tired mentally, and everything else goes from there. So, this, you know, some of the similarities was the conditioning and that stuff. Differences, you know, was just the pace and everything. You know, and there's some strong, strong guys in professional wrestling. I went to camp. In my camp, there was only like four or five of us, but one of them was Scott Norton, Scott Flash Norton. And this man had a little under a 700-pound bench press and was a world arm wrestling champ. And I'd work out with him, and I'd have better chance moving an oak tree than him, honest to God. I mean, people would just come in, because Brad was so respected, guys would come in, like the Road Warriors, Joe and Mike, you know, Animal and Hawk, they'd come in and visit and see how we were doing. Kurt Henning would be in there. And it was not uncommon that they'd come quite a bit, you know, just to see how things were going, if they could help out. And, you know, that was kind of neat, you know, because I'd never met those guys before. So, I mean, that was my camp, and it went for about, I think I started in February and went till about May. So it was a tough, tough camp, you know. There were people that got hurt and quit.
So how was that though? So you remained unscathed from the camp. Now let's talk about getting into the ring and for the first time for an actual pro wrestling match in front of an audience. Can you take us back in and how put the wheels in motion and describe that first match and how everything kind of came together for you?
I think the first match for me was in Winnipeg or somewhere. And it was against, and I'm not sure who it was against, but what it ended up being was in the business of Broadway. And if you know what a Broadway is, it's just a time limit match for like a half hour. And it was I can't remember who I wrestled, but it was some contender from Canada. And it was in somewhere outside of Winnipeg. But what I learned was that, you know, you just gotta, in the ring, it's so much about timing. It's so much about the right movements at the right time. And a lot of times, you know, especially starting out, you're green, you know, when you're green, you're new. So, you know, you can get lost sometimes in that ring real quick, you know, or you can get hurt real bad. But up to the grace of God, that first match, you know, it was a real learning experience, you know, and things I could have did better and other things that, you know, I had to work on. So, but your head start, your brain, you know, you're thinking so much, you're trying to figure out what move goes next. And that takes, you know, it takes time, the psychology in the ring, that's for sure. That's for sure. So.
Were there any guys in the locker room, veterans and the like, that would be giving advice, or did you approach anybody about any your matches and how you worked?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on the road, I mean, when I started in this business, the people I probably traveled with the most, honestly, was probably anywhere from Sean Waltman. Sean Waltman was a 16-year-old kid living up here, and I was like 21 at the time. You know, so me and Sean and Adnan El Casey, the Sheik, Jim Rasky, Baron Von Rasky was with quite a bit. I'd be on the road sometimes with Jim Brunzell. You know, all those guys would help. I was on the road with a lot. And those guys would take the time to watch my match and tell me, you know, what I did good and what I needed to work on. So, I mean, I had tremendous help from, you know, world-renowned wrestlers. World-renowned wrestlers that would, you know, take the time and watch and try to help me and improve. So, yeah, and it was a lot of neat people, you know. They were real cool people to hang out with.
Yeah, that must have been some interesting road trips and some good times, aside from just getting the wisdom, just the hanging out, because a lot of pro wrestlers love to share those days of getting into a car and hitting up a couple of spot shows.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, being in the locker room and on the road with these guys driving, that was the most fun, just being with them, you know. The show was kind of the, you know what I mean, the cherry on the ice cream, but... these were everyday guys that, you know, I grew up watching a lot of them that I was traveling with, you know, and it was so fun because a lot of them were funny guys with funny stories, you know, and just everyday guys, you know, and probably my first 6 months, I mean, working on shows, I was in awe, you know, I was like a fan. So, but they were so helpful to me and, you know, I still have lifelong friendships with some of them, you know.
When did you start to kind of feel a little bit more comfortable in knowing that, you know, you guys are peers, you know, some of these people that you grew up and admired? Did you find that, when did you find that comfort zone where you can chat and it just became, you were one of the boys?
I'm going to say probably after around give or take the first year, you know, because I had been around a little bit, had traveled quite a bit, had met these guys, had worked in the ring with some of these guys. You know, had worked out with these guys, had went out to eat with these guys, you know, who went to the bar with these guys and had a few beverages to get to know them. They got to know me. I got to know them, you know. So I would say probably around the first year, you know, I always tried to stay very humble at first, especially being new, you know what I mean? Because they could do a lot more for me than I could do for them. And so, I mean, I think around the first year, probably it was probably a little bit more, a lot more comfortable for me.
A company that I'm very familiar with, and some listeners up here are familiar with, aside from being the, you know, Minnesota being the AWA's main stomping grounds, was a company that was put together, a promotion in Minneapolis based, and that you had worked a lot with, was Pro Wrestling America, and with Eddie Sharkey, of course, the owner. Talk about how you got into Pro Wrestling America and meeting up with Eddie Sharkey, who, like Vern, was another very interesting and important character in the story of pro wrestling in Minnesota.
You ain't a kid in there. Eddie Sharkey's one in a million, that's for sure. I had, you know, because I had lived in the cities now, because that's where I trained, well, one of the first places you go, Brad said, you know, on independent to get work in the ring was Eddie Sharkey. Now, if you know Eddie Sharkey, you know, Eddie Sharkey has trained the Road Warriors. He trained Rick Rude. He trained Barry Dorso, who Barry Dorso is, you know, he was Smash the Demolition, and he was a Blacktop Bully. He's trained Scott Simpson. You know what I mean? Scott Simpson was, you know, Nikita Koloff.
Yep.
You know? I mean, he trained numerous tough guys. I mean, you know, like I said, probably the Road Warriors are the legend team, you know. But Eddie had shows. You know, he ran a small promotion around the Midwest. You know, he'd have a few shows a week. So, I mean, I was, when I first started, like I said, I was probably, I worked for Eddie the most. Probably it was me, Sean Waltman, probably Jerry Lynn, Charlie Norris, a big native wrestler from Red Lake, you know, and I think Charlie actually was the champ for a number of years. And then he'd have like a couple, you know, big names, you know, that were on a show, like give or take, say, Jim Brunzell or Kenny Patera or Baron Von Raschke or Tom Zink or somebody like that, you know, in the main event. But, I mean, Eddie, that's what he did. He ran a small show, you know, affordable, good show, you know, in the small towns all over Minnesota, North Dakota, Iowa, Nebraska, you know, Wisconsin. And then we're having some shows in Winnipeg, too, working for Tony Condello. But, yeah, I mean, if you were going to work in the cities, it was Eddie Sharkey because he had, the most shows with the most work. And But yeah, he had trained a lot of people, Eddie. Eddie was a character, that's for sure. He usually did the reffing. Eddie was doing the reffing all the time. So
that's what I can remember from Eddie Sharkey was going to a Pro Wrestling America show. It was in 1987. I can remember this. It was in the fall. It was Game 6 of the World Series because the Twins were playing, of course. And we got to the show in Thief River Falls at the old hockey arena. And we got there, and the ring wasn't there. Apparently, it about an hour and a half later, the guys came. I think it was Tom Burton who set up the ring for this show. Yeah. And it was, I can remember, these names will come back to you here, or come back to me, and I know you'll remember and love. We had Johnny Love, we had Skip Luther, we had The Outpatient, we had Tom Zink was there, Lethal Larry Cameron, who else did we have? Derek Dukes. And boy, what a show that was. And yeah, that's what I can remember from that. And Eddie was the ref, but we could talk about some of those guys. I mean, you definitely worked with many of them.
Well, I tell you, I had more respect, I mean, for Larry Cameron. Larry was about business, and he was very serious. And a lot of people, he was a loner, too. But if he liked you, we used to go to the gym and work out together. So I was very, very thankful Larry liked me. But this guy was a tough guy, and it's just, I mean, if you know, Larry passed away when he was wrestling in Germany. And it was real sad because I really liked him, and he was a tough guy, a legit tough guy. Derek Dukes, great guy in the ring, could work in the ring. Tom Zink, a real good guy working in the ring. Johnny Love was they were all good guys you mentioned, you know. Different styles, some of them, but, you know, they could perform, that's for sure. You know, that's for sure. So.
And I can remember it was the opening match was Skip Luther against Johnny Love.
I would bet that's probably when they almost probably both started around then, because I didn't start till 1980, I believe it was 1989, I believe I started. So that was before my time. So, but yeah, those guys were around when I started, especially Johnny Love, you know. And then Johnny owned a gym for a while. I used to work at his gym he had in Minneapolis. So real, real good guy. So, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Jerry Lynn. You mentioned him a lot because right around your run, that's when Jerry and Sean Waltman were tearing it up at such big PWA venues like George's and Fridley.
Yep. I mean, they had some – Jerry and Sean had some phenomenal matches. I mean, I probably wrestled at George's and Fridley, oh, man, a lot. I'm going to say a lot in that few years I wrestled. I mean, a lot. And, I mean, Jerry and Sean's matches, they were main event anywhere in the world. I mean, these guys, we were making very little money there, but yet, I mean, their work in the ring was just, I mean, it was phenomenal. I mean, main event times three, you know. They had phenomenal, phenomenal matches. And, you know, Jerry and Sean worked many times together. I mean, I don't even know how to emphasize it, but they were phenomenal matches. I mean, they would go for 45 minutes, and some of the stuff they did, I have no idea how they did it, you know. They'd be come out of that ring bloody and cut up and every other thing, but, you know, and the crazy thing is, they'd do that two or three times a week working with each other for a period of time. You know, the same match working just as hard, no matter where it was. But it was a main event match anywhere you went. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and
so,
it was...
Yeah, that, what's that?
It wasn't that much longer that they were down in Dallas doing their thing at the old Sportatorium for Global and being on ESPN, which basically propelled Sean and up to the WWF.
Yeah, Sean got his break, you know, and then he just was at the right place at the right time, and Vince wanted to do something with them. And if I remember right, I thought, you know, he went in there as the 1-2-3 kid or whatever for New York or for Vince, and they put him over like Ted DiBiase and somebody else. And I mean, the guy, he was so phenomenal in the ring. And yet he was so, his mind, the business, I mean, that's all he lived for. So he understood the business outside of the ring too, you know, and the psychology of it and how it worked and everything. I mean, I know he's had some issues in his life, but I mean, he is just one of the brilliant minds that was around for a long time. You know, never, he wasn't very big, but he just knew how to do what he had to, with what he had to do with his body size, he knew, you know, what to do. And, I mean, he was phenomenal, his high-flying activity. Him and Jerry Lynn. I mean, Jerry Lynn was just as good a worker, you know, So,
I mean, what a wonderful, I mean, for two guys to, I mean, it took Jerry a couple of years, a few more years than it did for Sean to really take the national spotlight the way Jerry did with in ECW. But again, their matches in Dallas, I bet those matches were, they were great, but I bet there was even better stuff up there in Fridley and other surrounding communities, because the way they upped the ante in those days, it, man, it was really some good high-flying stuff that kind of ended up becoming the norm in certain layers of professional wrestling.
George's in Fridley was a monthly show, and I mean, that place was packed. It was packed to the go. It was a small area, but it was an exciting area. It was a lot of people there, you know, that fit. I mean, there was, you couldn't move. It was shoulder to shoulder. You know, you had to get out into the ring there by security. Because otherwise, there's no way there was even an aisle to walk in there. So, I mean, that place developed a lot of people, you know, and it made them who they are just doing those matches there at the, I mean, you know. So, yeah, that's a neat, I hadn't heard of George's for a long time, but yeah, you're right there.
Was there any other venues that come to mind when you think of that had that feel in the loop where you worked for Sharky?
Well, you know, we went to Des Moines, Iowa quite a bit, and it was a small auditorium, but it was really, and I forgot what it was called, but it was packed all the time. You know, it probably only fit, and I'm guessing here, probably, I don't know, 500-600 people, but it would be packed, and it would be, you know, and it was crazy because, you know, they just got into the show so much. I mean, in a venue like that, you know what I mean? When I went to Japan and worked in Japan, that was a little bit different. A lot more people, a lot bigger auditoriums, you know, and they were a lot, but the Japanese fans are a lot more smarter to, you know, to the business, you know. They like a little bit more actual wrestling and holds back then when I was doing it, you know, so, and they like bigger guys. But probably the place in Iowa reminds me a lot because it was a monthly show for a long time, and there it was packed, and it was, you know, the wrestling fans really got into it there, you know.
This is Wrestling Memories Then and Now. I'm Glenn Broggett, and my guest is Randy Gust. He's also known as the Judge, Randy Gusto, Randall Gust. We're kind of sharing memories, some of Randy's memories of working in the Minnesota Independents in the late 1980s and 90s. And it's kind of fun because I could just throw a name out there from the era that you did work, and you've always seemed to have some great stuff to mention whenever I mention. Now it's kind of like either you got one little line or you got a little story. I want to know about a few more guys that were in wrestling that I got to see more in the AWA working enhancements, but ended up having a life on the Minnesota Midwest Indies. One of which was a man by the name of Red Tyler. Did you ever work with Red?
Many times on the same show as Red. Yes. Wow, that's a blast from the past too. I mean, Red Tyler was he worked for New York as a, you know, doing a lot of as talent enhancement. I mean, he worked a lot for New York. Pat Patterson, which was Vince McMahon's right hand man back then, I mean, liked Red. I mean, he just did, you know. Actually, on some spot shows, I think Red actually worked some spot shows, and they put him over, like on Tom Stone or somebody, you know. But I mean, on TV, usually he would do the jobs or that, right? But he worked for WWF a lot, and Pat Patterson liked them, so they let him keep working, you know what I mean? He'd have a payday every time. So, but Red was, Red was very into working out. Red was very into his diet. Red was, you know, and he had a certain regiment he did every day, and he wasn't going to get thrown off from that regiment, from his diet to working out to everything, certain time of the day. And if you traveled with them, you better expect to stop and eat somewhere, or you better stop at the gym, that's for sure, because that's what we did already. So, yeah, Red was a good guy.
I'm kind of throwing these blasts from the past in your direction here.
Yes, you are. I mean, a lot of these names I haven't heard for so many years. It's neat. It's really neat.
Well, I'm going to throw another one in because this guy was on the card, the first one I saw for Pro Wrestling America here in Thief River in 1987. was another guy who was had a real presence in the Minneapolis Twin Cities Indies, Tommy Ferrara.
Well, you do know these guys, don't you?
Oh yeah,
Tommy. Let me tell you about Tommy Ferrara. This guy had a story for everything. He could tell a story better than anybody. And when I started in wrestling, I think I was 21, 22 back in 89. Tommy Ferrara back in 1989 was probably 40 years old. And he looked good. Tommy wasn't that big, but he looked good, you know. And, I mean, anytime you went on the road with Tommy or you went on in the locker room with Tommy, he would tell stories from the past, from his life, from in wrestling, outside of wrestling. He never had a gray hair. He used to have hair feathered back, dark. You know, he was Italian, and he would just sit and he'd smoke cigarettes, and he'd just sit there and smoke and tell stories before the match. And then on the car, he'd be telling stories. He'd always be laughing. He definitely was not a boring guy to hang around with, and he had plenty of stories from, you know, who he had worked with to basically painting his house outside. You know, he could give you a heck of a story, you know. He was from Northeast Minneapolis, so, yeah, he was a real, real fun guy and a real, real good guy.
Another name that was all over AWA and, of course, worked for Sharky was a guy who I thought had probably one of the best drop kicks outside of Jim Brunzel, Ricky Rice.
I was going to say, you're not going to say Ricky Rice, are you?
Oh,
yes,
no.
He did. When you said drop kick, I figured that's who it was if it wasn't Jim Brunzel. You know, Ricky Rice had the run in the AWA and that stuff. I think Ricky could have really made it if he wanted to, but I don't know if Ricky really, how do I say this, had a passion for pro wrestling. He liked doing it every now, but, you know, the travel sometimes, I don't know how much he liked it. Sometimes he would, sometimes he wouldn't. He was very talented. You know, like you said, his drop kick was, you know, it was a top drop kick, you know. And so, I mean, but, you know, then he started just, you know, more so just getting out of wrestling where he wasn't traveling so much. But, I mean, when he was around, Ricky, you know, he used to have a gimmick called the Prophet, and that was a pretty good gimmick. So, but, yeah, I don't know what Ricky's doing now. That'd be interesting to know. But, yeah.
Here's one that's, guys, it's kind of become a mystery since he left the business. And he was, of course, a part of Pro Wrestling America. He was in the NWA and the AWA for a while. Was Tejo Khan.
Tejo was a good guy, man. He was very quiet, but he was always very, I mean, he was one of the nicest guys there was. I mean, he had a phenomenal build, you know, and he was just a great guy. Very, very easy to talk to. He didn't say a lot, but he was very friendly, though. When he'd come in the locker room, he'd smile, shake everybody's hand, see how we're doing, and maybe sit down and talk to you for a while. Well, yeah, I think Tejo maybe, if he would have wanted, could have went farther because he had the look. You know, he had the look, the build and that stuff, and he was such a good guy. So, yeah.
Yeah, and he came off the shoot pretty strong. I mean, he was, you know, not barely into his career when he was in the Body Slam movie.
That's right. Tejo, I think, if I remember right, I mean, I think he was going to, you know, I think he went down south for a while and maybe he got soured a little bit for a while with wrestling, you know, all the outside politics you got to deal with. But, you know, he had the look and he had the, and actually, me and him were actually, this is just a little tidbit for me. I was in a movie with Matthew Modine and Marissa Tomei. It was called Equinox. I was a bad guy on a bus. And I had a speaking part, and it's actually on there. But Tejo was in that movie, I believe, too, where we did the tapings on it. So I got to know him a little bit better there, too. Real good guy. But, yeah.
Another gentleman, and you mentioned him earlier, and he's a tried-and-true legend in the business. If he wasn't going by his other moniker of Billy White Wolf, we knew him in AWA country, and you got to know him a little bit more in the ring and outside of it. I'm talking about Cheek Adnan El Casey. Man, after reading his story and following him through all these years, man, what an interesting fella.
Adnan, I'm going to tell you, Adnan El Casey was probably one of the cheapest guys there was if you ever traveled with him. But he was a nice guy. He was very well-spoken, soft-spoken. Very smart man, you know, He was from Baghdad, Iraq, you know. I mean, he was from Iraq. And I mean, but he was usually very quiet in the car. And like I said, if you went anywhere, he wasn't going to pay for nothing, that's for sure. But he was still a good guy. But, I mean, yeah, I was on the road a lot with it. Because Adnan was working. Him and Eddie Sharkey, you know, were good friends. You know, him and Eddie would work out all the time together at a gym in Bloomington, Minnesota, together. So they were using Adnan all the time on the shows. You know, most of the time as a manager. But, yeah, he was, there's only one Adnan. And then he had his, you know, he was out of it for a while or doing small shows. And then he got that, you know, that short run with New York again with him and Slaughter and Hogan back in the day. So now I believe someone, he moved to Hawaii, I believe. He always had a place there, but I heard he lives there year round now. So
it's a nice way to end, you know, into the latter stages of life to have a little place. And it seems like if Adnan was getting all these things for free, he must have been saving up a nice nest egg.
Yes, he was. He was, you know, he'd always like, you know, back in the day when Vern Gagne, he'd always, Adnan would be screaming, "Vern Gagne, I got a big surprise for you." You know, he'd always be saying that, joking in the locker room or whatever. And, but yeah, he was a character, a real nice man. I mean, Adnan loved to be out in the sun. Say we were on a road show and we had nothing going on for a few hours, he'd just sit out in the parking lot on a chair with his shirt off and shorts and just, I mean, he was as dark as they came. He loved the sun, you know. So Hawaii, that's a great place for him,
mm-hmm. You know, and speaking of legends, another guy that did work around for Eddie on some shows was Baron Von Raschke.
Oh, wow. Jim Raschke was as good a guy as there was. Jim Raschke, if you ever talked to him, you could hardly hear him. He was so soft-spoken, you know. He was so soft-spoken, but he was one of the nicest, genuine people there was. You know, he was big into his family, you know, his kids. He had a daughter and a son, and, you know, that was his top priority. But anytime you had any questions for him or that, he was a patient man. He was a kind man. I mean, he still is. I mean, he's still alive. So, I mean, but Jim Raschke, I mean, I believe he was from Omaha, Nebraska. Great football player for the Cornhuskers and that. And, I mean, that guy had a long, long run, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And was as nice as they came. That's mm-hmm. for sure, that as nice as they came.
You know, you had some good moments in your pro wrestling career. I mean, you got to work with guys like Sheik and Raschke, and also with Ken Patera too. And I mean, talk about one of the all time strongmen of pro wrestling, and even outside of that, the Olympic strongman himself. He was also known to be quite a character, and I've heard in recent interviews he's still quite a character.
Let me put it this way: with Kenny Patera is very opinionated. That's probably, I mean, if you look at Kenny Patera, he is one of the strongest men in the business of professional wrestling, was one of the best heels in the 70s. I mean, how he looked and how he worked with the blonde hair and his strength. I mean, I really believe that he was probably one of Vince's and Vince's dad's, one of the top heels back then. The thing that has always stopped Kenny Patera is Kenny is opinionated and doesn't care who he offends. That's just Kenny, you know. Otherwise, I mean, you can't tell me some of those guys in the WWE Hall of Fame should be there before he was, because he was a main eventer. I mean, he was one of the few people that Andre the Giant let slam. Andre just didn't let anybody slam him, you know, in Madison Square Garden and that, but he let Kenny. But Kenny is very opinionated, and he will tell you, whether you like to hear it or not, Kenny's going to tell you what he thinks, and it ain't always, how do I say it? It ain't always a real nice and respectful how he says it. Kenny's going to say what he says, and that's it. And he don't care.
Just,
you know, but he's a very smart man. He had a couple degrees from Brigham Young University, you know, and he's legit, his strength and everything else, you know. So, yeah, he's an interesting character, Kenny.
Did you ever get to work with, like, Ray Stevens when he came back in very briefly in the early 90s, or was that where you...
You know what? Ray promoted a couple shows in the cities, and I worked for him. But I believe there's, like, a couple shows that actually Ray worked. I didn't work against him personally, but he worked in, like, tag team main events or that, down in shows around somewhere around the Twin Cities. But Ray Stevens was as good a guy as there was, too. You know, you could sit and have a beer with him, and he'd tell you stories from, you know, back in the 60s and everywhere else. And I mean, he was one of the best workers heels there was, you know, in the San Francisco area and everywhere. You know, real, I mean, he was fun to be around too. So
we're going to talk a little bit about you. You worked some for Vern with tapings in Rochester. Could you talk about the experience of working for AWA ESPN? Or yeah,
actually, that was the first time I ever worked for Vern. Was doing, you know, I was putting over a guy. I worked my first two matches against Coquina Maxima, which was
Yokozuna.
What was it? Yokozuna, okay? And then I worked against Tommy Jammer. Those were one of my early matches. And, I mean, it was something totally new to me because I was lost, you know what I mean? And it was just part of the learning curve, the experience. You know, I mean, I really didn't want to, you know, Brad always told me, don't worry about, if the other guy goes over or puts over, because you got to get your name out there, you got to get in the ring, and you got to get these promoters to know you. So, you know, I mean, as far as being in the locker room and learning, you know, just walking into the ring, that was huge. Because that did help me down the road with the AWA. Because I actually worked against, in Grand Forks, actually my hometown, a few months later, I can't remember, I worked against the Texas Hangman in an individual match against one of the Hangmen. And they were nice enough to put me over. You know, there was some screw finish where with the chair, and I got put over. And then a few times Greg needed somebody in short notice for an AWA spot show, and I would just get in my car and go, you know. And then when I thought, well, maybe I'll start getting some TV being put over, and that's when they shut down. They shut down in, what, 90 or 91, you know. So, but I was actually working for them quite a bit on the road at the end. And then, you know, their deal came to an end.
You mentioned the Texas Hangman. I happen to have had Mike Moran, a.k.a. Mike Richards, a.k.a. one of the Hangmen, on a previous edition of Wrestling Memories. And he had some stories that he shared about working the AWA, the Rochester tapings in general, and some of that stuff now that's starting to see the light of day with the Team Challenge and all of that.
I just wish with the AWA, Burton would have maybe changed with times, you know, and not maybe been so cheap with some of the, you know, the more upper talent. But, you know, Vern was pretty set in his ways, pretty stubborn, and, you know, the programs just seemed to, it wasn't what people wanted to see anymore, you know, and unfortunately, you know, then after being around for 40 years, the business had passed him by, I guess, and that's unfortunate.
I'm going to ask you a question now. We're going to go outside of the AWA and the PWA. And I've had a few people on talking about Herb Abrams, UWF. In fact, a guy that helped us arrange this interview, Jonathan Plombon, is putting together a book project. And I know that he's interviewed you about this. But the show, and I have seen this in rough cut online on YouTube, is a show that the UWF had put on a TV taping in Minot. It was during right around the time of the state fair at the Minot State University.
State fair, yes.
Good. And you ended up working with Al Burke, Mr. Outrageous. Could you tell us how you ended up getting on the card here for this UWF taping and what the atmosphere was like leading up to it and the event itself from your eyes?
Sure. Actually, I had worked with Al Blake and I worked with Bob Orton, but I heard that nobody's seen that footage. But yeah, I worked two matches, and one was with Bob Orton. But initially, I believe, and I'm trying to remember, but I believe I called Herb Abrams and said, you know, because it was from, basically I grew up right around Grand Forks, North Dakota, East Grand Forks, Minnesota. So I said, I'm from the state, basically. I see you got a show here. Can I get on it? And he called me back. You know, Herb Abrams was like a real, real small guy. He was a Jewish guy from, I believe he was from New York City. So, but he was running a show. He was based out of Vegas. And I called him and asked if I could get on it. And he got back to me and said, yeah, he could use me. So I go to the show. It was on a Saturday. I actually, he says, come to my hotel room when you get here and we'll talk. So I get to the hotel in Minot, And I go to the door in his room number. I find his room number and I knock on the door. And Herb starts talking to me through the door. He won't open the door. I'm thinking, well, I'm kind of a, you know, naive kid from North Dakota, Northwest Minnesota, but this guy's talking to me through the door. Yeah, I'll be downstairs at in this room at a couple hours, and we'll start the TV or we'll start the interviews. Thinking, well, that's kind of weird, start talking through the door, but okay, whatever. So I go down there. A couple hours later, I finally meet him, you know, face to face. You know, the real small guy. Then we go to the locker room. We start to, there's a bunch of matches because it's a TV taping. You know, that my first match, though, is with Bob Orton. You know, that goes okay. Then I work against Al Blake. And then, all right, so the show's over. So he says, well, come up to my room. Everyone's coming up to my room, and then I'll take care of, you know, pay and everything. So I say, okay. So I go up to his room. And it finally lets us in. A few of the boys are in there. I think like Brian Blair was there and a few other people. So he writes me a check, and I can't remember. It was for like $250. I was thinking, oh, cool, that's a nice payday for me. So I cashed the check. But the thing is, I guess before that, he keeps going into the bathroom. And I don't know what he's doing. I'm thinking, what the heck? He keeps going in the bathroom about every 10 minutes. Well, what I find out is, like a lot of people, you know, Herb might have had an issue with some addiction issues. But, you know, talking to him through a door and through, and he's going in and out of the bathroom. I didn't know that. I was still, I didn't really know the business that well on the outside part. But anyway, so I get the check. So I go to cash it. It bounces. So I say, oh, great. My first bounce check. So I call him, leave a message, say, you know, I know if I try to be threatening or mean, I'm not going to get nothing. So I just said, Mr. Abrams, this is Randy Gus. I work for you on this Minot North Dakota State Fair show. The check bounced. I was wondering, I said, you know, I played the card. Well, I know sometimes times are tough, but I was wondering, you know, I'd really need the money. I don't have a lot. And I'll be darned. He called me back, said, I'll send you another check. And he did, and it went through, you know. I thought once that bounced, I'd never see it again, but he did. But those are the things I remember about that UWF show in Minot.
Yeah, and I've watched some of the stuff on YouTube, and I've seen, like, there's clips, of course, of Steve Ray, the Wild Thing, I guess on a four-wheeler or something at the State Fair riding around, and then he's out participating and getting spun around in a little ride, and I remember that, and I had heard from Todd Becker about it, too, because he was on the taping as well.
Yeah, see, I don't remember any of, I mean, that part of it. I wonder if that was the day before or what was going on or where they had that taping, because, I mean, that's, when I got there, it was just in the auditorium at the locker room and the matches were going on, so that other stuff, I guess I wasn't familiar with, so.
I think it was just the day of the show, going out to kind of drum up and get a few people out there was kind of a part of that.
Sure. Oh, cool. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Japan briefly. Let's talk about how you got over in Japan and what, you know, what it was like to work in that culture, work with the workers. You talked a little bit about it, but let's talk about how you made it your way over to the Orient.
Well, actually, with Japan, for me, a couple things. One is, the first one was, you know, Brad Rangins was a booker for Japan for Masa Saito for New Japan. And actually, I worked for them for a tour. Basically, the first match working against, you know, young Japanese talent, in the, you know, and it was really interesting. They work real hard, the Japanese, real hard. It's almost nonstop, and they can put you in submission holds real quick, you know. So I mean, working for, and that was a major organization. Another organization I worked for there was called, it was a smaller organization in Japan, but actually I got hooked up through that one, and I went on numerous tours there, by John Layfield, if you know Jonathan Bradshaw, because John Layfield was trained by Brad Rangins a couple of years after I was. So Layfield hooked me up with this other tour in Japan, and I worked for them numerous times. Bill Irwin was on it, Rod Price from Texas was on it, You know, it was definitely interesting, the culture there. The people are very respectful. You know, they're very smart, too. They understand what's going on, you know. And usually for them back in the day, say booed some, usually was whistling of some sort. So, but, yeah, actually I was on a tour a few times with John Layfield. He was, you know, he actually got me over for the one organization. And then Brad got me over for New Japan and Masa. So, yeah, it was long tours, you know, long days on buses sometimes. But, yeah, the people, the culture was real nice, real nice.
Did you ever do any other international tours as far as, or was it just primarily Japan?
Well, I went to Sweden for a short time. If you ever remember a guy named Frank Anderson, he was a world, I don't know if he was world champion, but he was an Olympic Greco wrestler for Sweden. Well, he was trained, him and Brad Rangins knew each other. So I worked it was really in and out of, I believe, where was it in Sweden? I forgot what it was even. It was basically a show and I was in and out. And it was a very small show. So, yeah, my main thing was Japan.
Mm-hmm. And as we get close to wrapping up this interview, I want to know, when did you decide to, when you finally came at that crossroads, you decided to call it a career, and what led you to make that decision to finally really just kind of hang up the boots on pro wrestling?
You know, I had been doing it, I promised myself, by the time I started when I was like 21 or so, okay, and I said, I'm going to give myself till I'm 30, you know, and see what happens. Well, I went a little bit longer, but at that point, as I had went farther along into, you know, it had been around 7, 8, 9 years or 10 years. You know, I mean, if I hadn't got the main call from Vince then, and you know, they were pushing other younger people and everything else, I also realized for me, well, I have to make a career for myself in my life here. You know what I mean? If wrestling ain't gonna be it. So it was probably back in 1998, I just decided, you know, I got to make a career here of some change. You know, I have to look at the good things. I met a lot of great people, made a few bucks at it, seen the world somewhat, seen the United States, seen the Midwest all over, up and down many times. I just said, you know what, I've got to make a career for myself because I've seen a lot of wrestlers that were older that had nothing. You know, that had nothing. And I said, you know what? I'm still young where I can have a career. So I decided, you know, when I was in my early 30s, that I'm going to start a career. And with the grace of God, I've been with the Department of Corrections, Stillwater Prison, you know, for a little under 20 years, you know. But I knew that down the road, I needed a pension. I needed health insurance. You know, I need to have a paycheck coming in every, you know, couple weeks. I needed security. And for me, wrestling wasn't going to do that. And even the guys that have made money at wrestling, you know, Brad Rangins told me once, says, Randy, it don't matter if you make $10,000 a week if you're spending $12,000 a week. It ain't how much you make, it's how much you save, you know, especially for a lot of the guys that were making money that didn't save it. Well, I never forgot that, and I just said, you know what, I've got to have a career, and it's time for me to change. And, believe me, I had a lot of fun in the business of pro wrestling. I met a lot of neat people, you know, and seen the world like I had already said. So for me, there was no regrets. Sure, I wish I would have made it bigger, you know, but it is what it is, you know. So I got to look at the good times I had and what good came out of it, not the bad, because I could get real resentful, and that's, you know, I'm just not going to live that way. So I needed a career. I made a career. I've been very blessed with my career. There'll always be a prison, so I've been very, very lucky there. So I'm grateful with my career now working with the Department of Corrections. So that's how I basically left wrestling and went into the real world.
And it seems like you made the wise choice. Was there ever any times where you had those feelings where, there's so-and-so's having an event, maybe I want to pop in, or maybe I can get on the... Did you ever have any sort of itch, or if you did, how long did it take for that itch to kind of just go away?
You know what, I'll be true. Since I've been at the prison I've actually wrestled 3 times in the ring. One was actually a show in Thief River Falls. It was back in 2007 at the casino. I think it was 2007 or 2008. It was at the casino. My buddy, Charlie Norris from Red Lake, had it. and I actually worked against some younger talent there, you know. And my mom was there. My mom passed away, but she was there for that show. And she said, Randy, you've gotten a lot heavier, a lot slower, and everything else. So I never forgot that, okay? So, and then a guy I worked with at the prison actually owned a bar, and he had a couple shows there. So, and he wanted a wrestling show, so I'd actually worked with, if you know who Tony DiNucci is and that stuff, he and Todd Perry.
Yep.
He ran some shows, so, and I worked with French Lake Wrestling Association, and so I did those small shows. But otherwise, you know, I've been asked a couple other times to do things, but, you know, it was time for me to go, you know, and let the younger guys have their fun and do their things, because, you know, to make it big, it's so, so tough. You got to have timing. You got to have everything else go your way. You got to have them like you. It's a lot of politics, you know, and if you're willing to fight those politics, you know, then maybe you have a chance. But I seen it ruin a lot of guys too, but, and make them bitter. So I never felt that way really. So when it was time to go, it was time to go.
Back to that Thief River casino show. I remember that because I also remember Greg Valentine was on that event.
Actually, that tag team was, if I remember right, I remember at least a couple of them. Yeah, it was Greg Valentine and somebody against Charlie Norris, the big native from Red Lake, and Sean Waltman was on the show. He flew Sean in. That was the main event. It was nice to see the guys. Especially Sean, someone I knew since he's 16-year-old. But that's right, Greg Valentine was on it too. And I think someone else was supposed to be on it, no show. It was either Kamala or King Kong Bundy. I can't remember. But yeah.
Well, it looks like our time is about running down. I'd love to have you on sometime again. Maybe we can get you hooked up with one of the guys that you had an opportunity to work with during your career in pro wrestling, and we can kind of have a little conversation, just between, you know, the three of us, and I can kind of moderate between the two, because I think there's a lot more memories in there that we haven't even scratched the surface on.
Well, I'll tell you what, you brought a lot of back memories just by doing your show here, because, you know, I haven't talked about this for so long that it's really, it brings a smile to my face, you know, talking about the guys in the business. Because it's, believe me, pro wrestling, there's no other business than like it, that's for sure, you know. So, yeah, I appreciate you having me on it. I appreciate reminiscing, because it does bring a smile to my face, that's for sure.
A big thank you to Randy Gus for being on the program. I'm Glenn Broggett. You've been listening to Wrestling Memories Then and Now.